Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. President Trump's tariffs are having an impact on soybean prices, and that's a big deal for some farmers in the first state.
The price for soybeans for this year is the lowest that it has been in 5 years, at least. We've seen a drop in the price of soybeans of more than 20%.
Our Nick Schellino talks to Delaware farmer and past chairman and past president of the American Soybean Association, Richard Wilkins, about the tariffs' impact here. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about Hagley Museum's oral history of the Brandywine Valley Project and how it's becoming more accessible. Plus, the latest edition of the Midterm Matters podcast from the University of Delaware's Center for Political Communication. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. In response to U.S. tariffs on steel and other exports, the Chinese government has responded tit for tat, imposing tariffs on a list of American products. This includes a 20% tax on corn and soybeans. Shortly after the move, the price of soybeans on the global market dropped to a 10-year low and is currently less than $8.50 a bushel. Camden farmer Richard Wilkins was previously president of the American Soybean Association and is currently president of the Kent County Farm Bureau. He spoke with Delaware Public Media's Nick Schellino about the morale of farmers here in the first state in the wake of these tariffs.
It's been challenging. We started the growing season off with more precipitation with extremely wet conditions, but it quickly, as it often does, quickly turned the other direction to a short-term drought.
So if you had, project for this year's yield, do you anticipate it's going to be a good year?
No. At this point, yield-wise, production-wise, I cannot anticipate it being a good year. Those of us that do irrigate part of our acres, we do have the opportunity to put water on, to rescue a crop, to save a crop, but that sure does create a lot of additional expense with the fuel and labor and equipment capital cost of running that irrigation.
Well, on top of those challenges, the price has taken a bit of a drop. This is following a 25% tariff from the Chinese government on imports of corn and soybeans. Can you quantify this loss or say what this means to you on your farm?
Well, looking at soybeans as an example, the price for soybeans for this year is the lowest that it has been in 5 years, at least. We've seen a drop in the price of soybeans of more than 20%. We're 50% off of the high price that was set for soybeans about 8 or 9 years ago. Corn has been following suit, just as the other small grains have. And even the specialty crops, the vegetable crops for the processors, those contract prices are usually set by what the farmer's alternative crop could be, which in this area would be the corn and soybeans.
And does this harken back to anything from the past, something like maybe the trade embargoes in the 1980s, where farmers are kind of shouldering the burden of international trade?
Yes, it does. Unfortunately, food is one of those items that is required for sustenance. A person can get by without an automobile. A person can get by without a luxury home or a well-furnished home to live in. But food is one of those necessities that you cannot sustain life without food. So it has extremely high emotional value with people. And it's a shame that oftentimes political leaders use food as a weapon to try to achieve their political desires.
And what is the morale like among Delaware farmers? The prices are down, the trade war is underway, but you do hear some comments from the president, some tweets as well, about him not forgetting farmers, wanting to support them. Do you believe Donald Trump when he makes those kind of statements?
First, I'll say that Delaware farmers are not unlike other American farmers. We have an extremely strong, we're patriots. We have an extremely strong sense of patriotism. We believe in America as a model of democracy for the world to see. So, yes, I mean, we want our country to be strong. But we're also taught, many of us have been in 4-H clubs or FFA chapters, and you know, when you're taught the skills of a leader, we're always told you should lead by example. And that's something that I kind of see lacking right now is, you know, we're placing tariffs upon countries that have been our allies for decades and trying to impose trade sanctions against friends. That's not very good leadership, in my opinion.
Do you expect the price will bounce back? You've been in this game for a while. You've seen, like we mentioned earlier, the trade embargoes of the 1980s where the price took a drop, it comes back up. Do you expect the market will correct itself, maybe if not this year, then in years to come?
In the short term, I cannot see it happening in the short term. We were already in a declining period of the commodity cycle. You know, surely, agricultural commodities have a cycle that tends to last between 20 and 25 years between its peaks in the cycle. So we were already in that downward slope period of a long-term commodity cycle. You know, now we've got that being amplified by political sanctions against trading partners. And, you know, and these are markets, especially the China market. That's a market that the farmers built that market for soybeans there. Over 40 years.
It's the biggest market, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, it's the biggest market for agricultural products. It's the biggest market for soybeans in the world. And we invested tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars and 40 years of work to develop that marketplace. And they like our soybeans. They want to trade with us. But, you know, they're also a proud people. They're a proud culture. And this is going to be a tit for tat. I see this as possibly creating long-term damage, not just to soybeans, but to all agricultural products. You know, I said earlier that food has a huge amount of emotions attached to it. You know, Americans, we are blessed with an abundance of really inexpensive food. We have the least expensive food of any other nation in the world. Other nations that have to spend a lot more of their income for their food, for their sustenance, for something that's really necessary for them to be able to survive, they want to make sure that they can get that food from a reliable supplier, someone that's not going to use their inability to be able to source food as a ploy to achieve some other political goal. So this has long-term implications as the United States, whether the United States can be considered a reliable supplier.
Well, if to your mind you don't see a short-term fix in the market and a potential for long-term damage to agriculture in the United States, what does that mean for young people maybe taking out loans and looking to get started as a farmer?
That's what concerns me a lot. Over the last decade or so, we have had a nice influx of youth coming back into our industry. You know, we had the period of time, like during the commodity cycle, when we had really nice profits that could be had by working these long hours and these making these sacrifices in order to be in this industry. But we had young people coming back in. A lot of those young people have incurred debt based on what they thought was going to be a long-term commodity profitability. They're the ones that are at most at risk. And then that's compounded by those people that maybe were looking for careers in production agriculture that maybe are second-guessing that now. my wife and I, we have a farm here that we're, you know, we're looking for who, what our legacy is going to be, who is going to take over the reins of our production farm for the future. And, you know, it's really difficult when you're asking young people to, you know, to work 100-hour weeks this time of the year, to sacrifice other, you know, abilities to go to other social events and socialize with their friends because the needs of the business and the needs of the farm are greater. They get discouraged very quickly when there's not much profitability there.
Richard Wilkins, any final thoughts?
I hope that we can return to diplomacy. I hope that we can have leadership to sit down at the negotiation table with our current trading partners, with potential new trading partners, and with our allies, and try to work out the solutions to these challenges.
Thanks to First State Farmer and President of Delaware's Kent County Farm Bureau, Richard Wilkins, and our Nick Shalino for their time on The Green this week. And stay with us. We'll have more on an oral history project at Hagman Museum that's becoming even easier for researchers and the public to access. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delawareans have a variety of windows into the state's past they can look through, and one at Hagley Museum and Library allows them to travel back and get a taste of First State history from those who lived it. Between 1954 and 1990, Hagley Museum staff and volunteers interviewed more than 150 individuals who lived and worked in the Brandywine Valley throughout the late 19th century and early 20th century. Today, researchers, members of the public, and descendants of those interviewed can now listen to the full collection of these Brandywine Valley oral histories in an online exhibit. Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele spoke with Roger Horowitz, director of the Center for the History of Business, Technology, and Society at Hagley Museum and Library, to gain some insight into this collection.
Well, the collection is about 350 hours of interviews with men and women who worked and lived around the powder yards in the Hagley Museum, really back in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Okay, and delve into the background a little bit. What years are we talking? How far back are we going here?
Well, the interviews were recorded, some of them in the 1950s, some of the 1980s. They've recently been made far more accessible by going onto our website. They're indexed, and so you can easily move around in them. Since the interviews were conducted some time ago, the oldest memories go back to the 1870s and the 1880s, which is extraordinary. And a lot of the memories and conversation are about the early 20th century, you know, the aughts and the teens. So it's really a way of a window into the past in a way that we rarely have access to today.
I'm sure you've listened to some of the conversations. What are some of the more interesting ones personally you've listened to?
Well, the ones that always affect me are the stories of childhood. You know, we think about childhood in the early 20th century, you know, no electronics, no television, no phones. Really, electricity being very, very rare. So what did children do? They played games, and they related to each other, and they played pranks, and they did all sorts of kinds of things. They went to dances. They socialized. They swam. They ice skated. They went, you know, they did all sorts of things. And these children's games, the way they're, you know, talked about, is so powerful, so evocative. You can imagine what it was like to live along Brandywine Creek in 1905. Hot summer day like today, what did you do to entertain yourself during the day? School's out, what did you do? What did your mother make for dinner? You know, what kind of food did you eat? What did your house look like? Where were your friends? Where were the neighbors? So these stories just bring us back to an earlier time in a way which is seen through the eyes of people who went through it themselves. Very, very powerful stuff.
Let's take a quick listen to one of those fascinating stories of childhood. Rocco Perrone was born in Italy in 1901. His family emigrated to the Brandywine Valley, and his father worked for Colonel Henry A. DuPont as a stonemason. Jackson. Now, in this clip you're about to hear, Perrone shares a story about skipping school and falling through the ice while skating on Evelina DuPont's pond in the winter. Take a listen.
Now, what time did you get out of school? Do you remember that?
3 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. And did you have work to do after school?
Oh, yes. I had to feed my, shell all the corn and feed the, my roosters, and then I had 6 horses to feed.
Mm-hmm.
One time I played hooky. I didn't go to school because I had, like, bronchitis.
Mm-hmm.
So I told Mom I'm going to feed the horses, and I snuck the skates under my overcoat. Then I went down Miss Luna DuPont's pond and skated down there.
Mm-hmm.
Met the other boys. And what happened? The ice broke and I went down.
Oh!
Oh, my Lord. So I made a fire, tried to get dried up, but I'd freeze in the front and dry in the back. And so it came to me, I went to the neighbors. Frank Rosino. He moved to what's the name of that place up there? Boothwyn.
Boothwyn.
Mm-hmm. But he was working for Miss Evelina DuPont. So his wife said, "Oh, what'd you do, Rocky? Did you fall in the water here? And the ice broke." So she gave me a pair of pants from her husband and a shirt. And I took my old clothes when I went home. I just hid in my dad.
And they never knew you.
They didn't know it right away, but then, after a while, my mother, she found that because she found the pants and the shirt all getting moldy.
Uh-huh.
You know, drying up slow.
Yeah.
I told her then.
You never forgot that, I guess.
I never forgot that. Oh, my goodness.
Funny story there, Mr. Rocco Perrone, as a child, falling through the ice.
Roger, did you get a sense, you've painted a rosy picture so far, did you get a sense in listening to any of the collections that life was hard back then?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you also hear the stories of the explosions, the powder mill explosions, and the people who were sent out on the details to collect the body parts of the people who were in the explosion, because when you died in the powder mill explosion, your body came apart, and all those pieces had to be picked up for burial. So you hear those stories. You hear stories of the flu epidemic of 1918, not what we hear today, oh, millions died. You hear individual stories of neighbors who lost their little girl. There's one very powerful story about a woman describing how her friend, her little friend, died, and the father was in a position of having to bury her because they couldn't get an undertaker. No one wanted to go near the bodies. So yes, you get some very, very tough stories of a life that is hard for us to imagine.
Is this the first time that Hagley Museum and Library has ever offered up oral history collections to the general public?
Well, this collection has been around for a while, but it's been hidden. So what we've done is we've made it far more accessible and easy for the public to access. Think about it this way. It used to be simply available on transcripts that, of course, are by their nature silent. And you had to come to our library, request them to come out there, and then you sat and you read them, which is a very different way of accessing them. Some years ago, we discovered that we had the original recordings, but they were on tapes that were very fragile. And so we couldn't let you listen to them in case the tapes broke. But what we did is that we digitized them, which is to say we converted them from tape to computer files. That was the big breakthrough. So that allowed it, made it possible to listen to these. And then with this website we've created, we've made it easy for people to access these interviews, especially to look for their relatives. If they have a last name in which there's a family member, they can look on the webpage. It says, find your relative, and you maybe will find a relative, and you can click on that link. It'll take you right to the recordings, and you can go right to the recordings and listen to the person and read their biography. So yes, this is really a breakthrough for us in making this accessible for a large audience.
So how can the public access these recordings?
Well, actually, the easiest way for people to access the collection is to go to Google and enter in Brandywine Valley Oral History Project, or just Brandywine Valley Oral History. And they will go right to where pages for the collection, they can see it'll come right up. Other way they can do it is they could go and enter in just Brandywine Valley Oral History Project with dashes between them, and it'll come right up.
And how long will this collection be up that people can go and listen?
It's up, and it's not going anyplace. I don't know how long the Having Museum and Library is going to last, but you know, it's up. It's not going away. People can access it at their leisure. It's not going anywhere. So it's not like an exhibit in a museum where you have to go see it right now. This is up there, and it's going to stay.
What else about the collection is interesting to you, interesting to the general public that we haven't discussed that people need to know about?
Well, if you want to know what work was like in the early 20th century, there's amazing stuff in there about work. And what we did with this website is we have, if you will, some greatest hits, you know, little clips organized that you can go and access. So you can look at it, you can click at a section which says Working on the Brandywine. You can click on a section which has recreation, entertainment, holidays and traditions, food and drink, childhood and mischief. And if you click on these links there on the, from the webpage, you'll be able to quickly hear a number of different clips about how people did things. We have a guy who did the peeling of the willows with his father, which was very important, making gunpowder. We have a guy who actually did research for DuPont on creating tracer bullets. We have pipe fitters. We have stories of the Bloomer Girls, the women who came into the powder yards during World War I to help with production. So we have a lot of these interviews that are not only the full interviews with indexes to them, but we also have picked out some clips to make it easy for people to quickly understand and see what's good there.
Thanks to Director of Hagley Museum's Center for the History of Business, Technology, and Society, Roger Horowitz, and our Kelly Steele for their time this week on The Green. The collection is available at hagley.org. And stay with us. The Green continues with the latest Midterm Matters podcast from the University of Delaware's Center for Political Communication. But first, a check of your local news. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you another edition of the Midterm Matters podcast from the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication. The podcast is part of the Center for Political Communication's upcoming national agenda series, Midterm Matters, addressing the importance of voter and civic engagement in midterm elections, as well as campaign strategy, news coverage, polling, and more. In this episode, I'm joined by UD Center for Political Communication Director Nancy Karabjanian and the CPC's Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director Dr. Lindsay Hoffman. This edition of the podcast has been edited slightly for time.
There is no summer vacation for politics in this midterm year.
Maybe we should do some breathing exercises before we get started.
Exactly, because we've got a lot of things that are popping up that I would say are making people anxious and making them angry. And that's a great place for us to start because the Center for Political Communication recently released a poll looking at how anxiety and anger will affect and perhaps motivate voters. Lindsay, can you walk us a little bit through the poll and what you found as you polled about how these issues are kind of creating both, I guess, like, you know, angst and anger?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I started getting interested in emotions during midterms in particular in 2010, mm-hmm. when the Tea Party kind of was emerging. And we began to see people walking into town hall meetings, you know, carrying their guns and shouting at their representatives. And I kind of was curious, you know, what causes this, or what are the, not just what causes this emotion, but what are the effects of this type of emotion? So doing some research over the past, you know, decade or so, I've discovered, and my colleagues have discovered, that certain emotions can make people seek out more information. Other emotions can make people actually go to the polls and be active. And what I found interesting about the poll that we just did, which is that this kind of extreme anger and anxiety that people are feeling when they think about politics, those two emotions in particular are what motivate action. So when people talk about what's going to happen in the midterms, are the millennials going to show up? Are, you know, we typically have such a low voter turnout during the midterms. Is this year going to be different? So that was one of the things I was interested in looking at. But one of the kind of side bars that I found was a difference in gender, that women who, again, are this voter block that we often ask, are they going to go out? Are they going to be more for Democrats or Republicans? It's an interesting voter group to watch. They are significantly more angry and anxious than their male counterparts.
And I was going to say, I mean, one of the things you noted when we talked to you for our story on this poll for Delaware Public Media is that you said that anxiety leads voters to pay more attention to politics, while anger leads to more participation, including turnout, social media sharing, things like that. So I guess my question for you is, in the end, do you think the anger or the anxiety winds up having more impact?
I mean, it's a good question. And you have to also wonder how many of these people are feeling both of these things and what's the kind of combined effect of them. I think that that's probably a big part of it. But I think the thing about anger as well is that it also motivates, from my research, posting comments online and, mm-hmm. and engaging in conversations online. And I think one of the things that emerges from this is seeing kind of the dialogue online spurring more anxiety and anger, and then creating an avalanche of even more dialogue. So it's kind of a cycle effect.
The question that keeps bubbling up in my head, and I'm curious to know what you've learned over the last 10 years, at what point does anger and anxiety lead to exhaustion? And we just tune out.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, it's difficult to do longitudinal research like that to sort of track people's emotions over time. Maybe that's something we could talk about doing, but I think you're absolutely right. And I think that that's what we're seeing in this moment. We were just talking before the podcast about how a lot of people are just kind of like, okay, this is just another event in the tide of events that's happening in this country at this moment. And, you know, in a few days, we'll move on and we'll forget that it happened. So I think I think it's a cyclical thing that we see. One of the things that I notice is that I think part of it is we see our representatives and people in government expressing that same anxiety and anger that we are feeling, and I think that amps it up. So it just feels like we're at a very, very hot boiling point.
Sort of like the clips we saw from the hearings on Congress where they were fighting more among themselves than really asking questions. And the other thing that I think is important to note over your research, if we look back 2 years, it was anger and anxiety that led the Trump campaign to play to that base. And it was their anger and anxiety for being felt left out and marginalized that gave us what we have.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, these emotions are very powerful in a political sense in getting people out. I should note that we also asked people about their feelings of hope and pride. And those were not a lot, but they were less. People are feeling less hopeful and less proud when they think about politics in general. But not surprisingly, there's a huge gap between Republicans and Democrats on that. So Republicans in this poll, which is a national poll, reported feeling more hope and more pride compared with Democrats. So, you know, it's a very partisan thing too. These, you talk about Trump kind of fueling the, using that anger and running on that anger. I think this time around, Democrats are probably going to apply the same tactic.
So I do want to talk about some of the issues that are causing all this anger and anxiety. Certainly a lot of anger about President Trump's performance overseas with NATO, and especially his summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin, seeming to take Putin's word on the Russian election hacking over U.S. intelligence and law enforcement. So the question I have for you two is, does this, as well as the additional indictments from the Mueller investigation, make it more likely that the midterms may be a referendum on the president?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't. I think that we are looking at the new definition of the Teflon president. And, you know, it's today's big boiler issue. Mm. But in another, you know, as we've seen with all of them, from Charlottesville to Access Hollywood, it just fades away. And when you say one thing in a press conference with another world power leader, and then you retract it, and then you tweet the opposite, nobody knows where anything is. So the confusion is going to become more amplified, and I don't think it's going to impact.
Yeah, I think people are just utterly confused. I mean, I think we've heard Congress people say, I don't know. I don't understand. And it's such a violation of the decorum of the office that I think we just haven't been here before, at least not in my memory. So it's kind of, it's exactly what you're saying. He can sort of when the president says something, like, for example, that tabloid interview he gave in the United Kingdom, he said something about, I can't remember what it was that he said.
He was critical of Theresa May, yeah. Very right, critical
right,
of her.
Right.
And then she was a great leader.
And then he basically was like, oh, that's fake news. I never said that. And they're like, we have it on tape. And I mean, you go back to Access Hollywood, it's on tape. You go to the press conference, everyone is watching you and Putin live on television. We saw it happen. And so what he does is he doesn't make it, when it's not on tape, it's fake news. But when it is on tape, he just changes what he meant. And it's like, how can you argue with, well, that's not what I meant? Even though the what he did mean makes absolutely no sense if you put it together. So I think it's, going back to this kind of feeling of exhaustion that when you have a president who is willing to go to such great lengths to, in my opinion, protect his ego over, real diplomacy, it's exhausting.
I think that the tell will be if Fox News continues to be critical of the president on this issue. They were very harsh on him, looking directly to the camera. And, to me, that was fascinating because they know he's watching.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they continue to be as critical, I think we'll see that this particular, perhaps you could call it a misstep, I think that's a little soft,
mm-hmm.
Will have legs to carry through. But it is only July, and we're an instant generation.
Well, I was just going to say, because the next topic I want to talk about is the one that seemed to be a really big deal until the president went overseas, and that is his nominee for the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh. When I talked with Widener University Delaware Law School Dean Rod Smola a week ago before that trip, he said, this nomination is going to bring a tectonic shift to the courts. It's going to lead to contentious confirmation hearings that could really, linger day after day after day. That'll galvanize each side's base. And then all of a sudden, it's kind of yesterday's news. But I guess the question I have for you guys is, because this one is likely to pick up again and is one that has maybe a lot more long-term implications, does this one have a little bit more, perhaps, impact on voters heading into this midterm election as we get closer to it?
I do want to address that, but I want to go back to something that Nancy said
sure.
before about Fox News in particular. I saw something on Twitter from Nate Silver, who does polling and 538 and all this, and he said, we need to have some sort of rating system for when those scales are going to tip, and it would be like if Sean Hannity says something. I think next was Tucker Carlson. And it's like there are certain people that I think if they go against him, it could shift his take on things.
Sure.
But anyhow, I liked the idea of sort of a rating system of what would make
have their little faces instead of stars.
<Exactly. laughs>
I think, again, the Kavanaugh nomination has gotten sort of swept away in the day-to-day of Trump's European vacation, if you will. I think that it's clearly going to be in the news. Mitch McConnell and other Republicans are saying, we will get this done before the midterms. We have our own Tom Carper saying, I will not, vote on this before the midterms. So this is clearly going to be an ongoing story that's going to last through to the midterms.
I don't know if it's going to hit hard, though, with voters. I mm-hmm. think voters feel the Supreme Court is so far out of their reach, so far above their daily life. And we're seeing that people are becoming more focused on me as opposed to my country. Mm-hmm. It's all about, how is this going to affect me? I think one thing that might hit more than the Supreme Court would be tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
I think once we see people get hit financially in that belt that supports Trump, we'll have problems.
But I do have to say this with the court, though. I think there may be some more me issues involved here this time, though. I mean, you're looking at Roe v. Wade and abortion on the table, affirmative action, LGBTQ rights. I mean, there are a lot. I mean, because it could be such a major shift in some of these decisions, not just kind of, replacing one conservative with another conservative. I mean, if you're a politician trying to make a case about it, I mean, you can talk to people personally and be like, you're going to lose this right and you're going to lose this right. Do you think that case can be made? Or is Nancy right that the court, it's just this thing that's up there that...
I think I tend to agree with Nancy because, when you look at, I teach media and politics, and one of the things that I talk about when I talk about the Supreme Court is everybody has pretty positive opinions of the Supreme Court, partly because there are no cameras there. There's no like overwhelming media coverage of these decisions unless they're those big decisions that mm-hmm. you're talking about. So if you think about the way Americans pay attention to politics, they're paying attention to this day-to-day back and forth between Mitch McConnell and you know, Trump or whoever it might be. The Supreme Court comes up pretty irregularly, and you're not seeing so that's why we consistently have high ratings of Supreme Court, because people are like, oh yeah, I think they're doing a good job, right? But oh, Congress, oh god, they're a mess, you know, because you see it. So I think that it's what's going to be contentious and what's going to be in the news is the congressional fights about it. I don't know if Americans are going to have that kind of Roe v. Wade LGBTQ rights kind of front and center in their mind.
Well, let's move on to another topic, and that is the primary victory of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She defeated a longtime Democratic incumbent, Joe Crowley, up in New York. And much of what we're hearing in this discussion is a suggestion that other similar style upsets could be possible. So the question I put to you is this result a harbinger or an outlier?
What do you think?
Yeah, everybody's looking at me.
I think it's an outlier.
Yeah?
Yeah, I do.
Well, and it is New York, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think what's interesting to me is, you know, just I saw this on Twitter recently that right here in Delaware, Harris's campaign is being supported by the same folks that supported Ocasio's upset win. And we saw an email from Tom Carper recently that actually addresses this directly and says there's an outside group running Facebook ads attacking Tom. So I think it's a little bit different because we are seeing a well-supported candidate addressing the fact that he has this competition.
Though I did find it interesting, because I do want to get into this, because clearly that's one of the races that has been in almost every national article that's discussed this possibility of it being a harbinger, is the race between Kerry Harris, progressive upstarts, grassroots candidate, primarying Tom Carper, Harris biracial, openly LGBT, an Air Force vet, though, as well. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, you know, she's been publicly backed by Ocasio-Cortez. Some of her people are reportedly coming in to help with her campaign. And if nothing else, certainly it's added energy to Harris's campaign, which I thought was kind of really below the radar until this happened. What I found interesting about the way Carper has responded is I feel like he's trying to walk this very fine line, because traditionally incumbents in Delaware tend to just ignore, like they pretend they don't exist, these people who would primary them.
Until Christine O'Donnell.
Well, but even after Christine O'Donnell.
Got there because she was ignored.
That's right. Right. That's right.
But this is the thing. But even in the Carper emails, they don't talk about, they never mention Kerry Harris's name. Never mention her name. They do mention that there's people coming in. And so they're acknowledging that there is this pressure, but they're not acknowledging the candidate. And they're not, and I don't think they will be, unless it becomes clear that there's more energy behind her campaign than just people outside talking about it. I think they will stick to that strategy of not kind of giving her any credence by directly engaging her.
I think Senator Carper also has to worry about the placement of this primary. Mm-hmm. For it being on a Thursday opposed to a Tuesday, for it being in September when it's back to school time, back to school night, et cetera. I think that he should take a look at the Mike Castle situation and study that and see how he can motivate voters. She's going to have to do the same. They're both going to have to motivate voters to actually bother to vote because Delaware's primaries in September are usually so low, with such a low attendance, such a low voter turnout, you can have surprises like we did for Mike Castle.
But I do think there's a little bit of a difference here. I mean, I think when you look at O'Donnell's victory, I mean, the way...
And this is 2010.
Correct.
That Tea Party sweep.
Exactly. And that Tea Party part was the big part of it, because she basically ran up the score in Sussex County and in southern Kent County. And Castle did not do enough work to motivate voters, the moderate Republicans in northern Newcastle County, to make up that margin where she ran up the score in the South. I don't know the dynamic works that way on the Democratic side. I don't think there's a huge pocket of progressives somewhere that could be energized where Kerry Harris is going to be able to run up the score. I would think maybe their thought would be Wilmington, that they'd try to energize the city of Wilmington and force Carper to win almost everywhere else. But I don't even know if in Wilmington you can get enough people to be energized to vote for her over Tom Carper. And I think, you know, we've seen, you know, some of the articles have acknowledged. I mean, you know, this is kind of Carper's whole theme. It's like, I'm not Joe Crowley. I show up places. People see me. Mm-hmm. They talk to me. I'm not an absentee politician. I think the dynamics might be a little bit different. I think she still obviously has energy that she didn't have before.
I think that's a good point in terms of like pockets of, you know, progressives hiding somewhere along Rehoboth Beach probably. But I'm not a Delaware native, and I'm curious. I have a question. Now I'm going to ask the question.
Sure.
For a state like this, that's this small and that you expect to kind of meet and know the candidates, does it matter if they are from Delaware or not? Does it matter that they're...
Well, Tom Carper's not from Delaware.
Because Harris isn't from Delaware. I mean, her connection is through Dover. So I just was curious if that's ever been an issue, if that...
I don't think you have to be a, you know, quote-unquote real Delaware. I think you do need to invest in meeting people. And I think there still is... I think it's less than maybe it used to be, but I do think there is still a retail politics here that's necessary that may not be necessary elsewhere.
And if you look at where our high-profile candidates put their children in school... You know, when they're running, the majority of them put their children in public schools, because that is one of those other little tipping points in Delaware. Are you one of us? The only candidate that I know of recently that's been able to get away with that is John Carney, because his wife works at a private school. Mm-hmm. So he had a really good answer for that.
Mm-hmm. And the DSEA, by the way, has already endorsed Tom Carper. So the teachers union, which is a big, getting that endorsement is a big deal in the state, has already endorsed him. And again, I think that's part of the mathematics here. He's got a lot of these union endorsements that if they can motivate their people to vote, it becomes that much harder for Kerry Harris to...
The questions are going to be age, I think. If she mm-hmm. brings up age, Carper's been... This is familiar territory
sure.
for him. I mean, remember the Janet Rusnicki race and how down and dirty that particular race got with outside forces coming in. But I think your point about Wilmington is a good one, because there's a lot of really interesting Wilmington races. And Wilmington lives and dies by the Democratic primary, because you rarely find a Republican surfacing to the top in the city.
Well, I think one more thing to note about Harris is the fact that women, you know, we kind of talk about this, the year, is this another year of the woman? I think that what we're seeing is a lot of women, there's been some good journalism in the New York Times about this, women really running pretty unconventional campaigns, not wearing the pantsuit, not, you know, being stoic, but being vulnerable. And I think that if Harris can kind of capitalize on that, and she is, you know, a unique candidate in that
sure.
sense. I mean, you know, especially the fact with a military background, she's such a, you know, kind of pro-peace, you know, candidate. I think that if she kind of runs a very untraditional campaign and can connect with these folks in Wilmington in particular, you know, Ocasio's a pretty interesting example that we've seen already. But again, I think the question is, will it apply to Delaware?
It's going to be interesting to watch. I think probably in the next month or so, we're going to see a lot more with this campaign to see... Is there that kind of energy, that grassroots energy that can be built?
The state fair is coming.
Well,
the big buttons will be out.
Exactly. I do want to talk a little bit more about the Delaware midterm ballot writ large. The GOP did finally find some candidates to field for U.S. House, Attorney General, and State Auditor. Those candidates all very big underdogs, clearly. But I guess the question I have for you is it necessary, though, to have names at the top of the ballot to help them down ballot, where there are 12 seats in the General Assembly that are open due to retirement? You just can't have those top lines empty and hope to be successful down ballot.
I absolutely agree. The GOP, if it's going to rebuild itself and at the very least retain its one statewide office, it needs to have names on the ballot without question.
All right. I think it should be interesting to see, because, I mean, some of the names they put up there, it seemed to be ones that have credentials, at least. And I think that's one of the things that they've suffered from in the past, is they've had some names up there, but they maybe weren't credentialed. But they do have...
We didn't even know who they were until
exactly.
they declared their candidacy.
Exactly. But you have, like, you know, James Fidola running for auditor. He has run before for state senate. You have, you know, they found a prosecutor to run for attorney general against all the Democrats who have prosecutorial experience. So they did find some people who can kind of go into debates and things like that and have, you know, at least a... Well,
they're playing the long game,
exactly.
way beyond 2018.
exactly. With that, we will move on to our final piece of the podcast, which is, as we always do, a quick hot take, a hot quick take, whatever you want to call it. Who wants to start this time?
I'll go. You know, it's hot outside. It's July. I thought I'd do a hot take. this time around. Hot, quick take, whatever you like. So it's hot. You know, people like to go to the pool. Going to the pool during the summer is just one of these great things you can do when it's just so hot. Right here in Delaware, not long ago in Wilmington, the mayor had to apologize after some Muslim campers, children who were in a part of a Muslim camp, went to a public pool in Wilmington, municipal pool, because they had kicked these children out because they were wearing, supposedly because they were wearing cotton. So basically, they were wearing clothing to cover themselves up modestly according to, you know, their traditions. The city officials have gone back and forth on this, saying that there's a rule against wearing cotton in the pools because cotton poses a safety risk and strains the pool's filtration system. I actually did a deep dive on this and went into the health systems protection in the Division of Public Health. Under bathing suits, there is nothing about cotton, wearing cotton. This isn't about cotton, right? And what it is about is a long-term history of pools, public pools being this battleground for wanting to feel safe and private and protected from people who are not like you. We know this. We remember this. When Mimi Jones made history at a segregated pool in St. Augustine, Florida, when at a motel where the motel owner ended up pouring acid into the pool to try and get those African Americans out of the pool. We've seen this just earlier this year in Germany. A town near the German cities of Cologne and Bonn has banned male refugees from the municipal pool because women have complained that they are worried that they will be sexually harassed. So I think what's really fascinating, and there's this great book that's about kind of how things play out at city pools. And I think that what's fascinating to me is that we're seeing the same patterns repeat themselves over and over again. And what's happening is that there are some real consequences to this in that African-American people are much more likely to drown than other children. They're 5.5 times more likely to drown than other children, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. 64% of African-American children have no or low swimming ability. So that's the majority of them. So I feel like, you know, that these stories come up occasionally about children at pools being kicked out of pools or being, you know, ridiculed at pools, but there are real consequences to these sorts of things. And it just seemed to me in a hot summer, it's worth talking about how we all have a right to go to the pool and to, you know, have a good, quick break in the pool. So that's my hot take.
Politics of the pool. Lindsay, thanks. Nancy?
Mine's a bit of a journalism one. When I watched the Trump-Theresa May press conference and he refused to take the question from CNN calling them fake news, I was angry that the only comments about that were after the press conference. I think that as journalists, we need to stand up for each other, and it was never really done in that moment, and that is the moment to stop this. I was thrilled. I stopped screaming at the press conference and stood and actually applauded when the Reuters reporter, Jeff Mason, asked his questions at the most recent summit press conference with Putin. And I think that we all should acknowledge that kind of courage of asking the really tough questions, of not backing off, of staying that true. His questions were, as Michael Barbaro from the New York Times tweeted, so well crafted that they demanded an answer. And I think that's something that the press corps covering the administration, the midterms, everything, they need to start focusing on. Stop allowing, be journalists and cover the story instead of following the lead.
Thanks again to UD Center for Political Communication Director Nancy Karabjanian and the CPC's Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director Dr. Lindsay Hoffman for their time on the Midterm Matters podcast, produced by the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication and Delaware Public Media. You can hear the full podcast at DelawarePublic.org or at the UD Center for Political Communications website, cpc.udel.edu. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all who helped make today's show possible. Nancy Karabjanian and Dr. Lindsay Hoffman from the UD Center for Political Communication and the Midterm Matters podcast. And Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.